Benjamin O'Leary Sines is addicted to storytelling. It doesn't matter if it's for adults, young people, or children, which may be why he won 2 Lambda Literary Awards in 2013, one for his young adult book, Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, and the other for his collection of 7 stories for adults called Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club. The book is centered around a popular bar in Juarez, Mexico, where the border was once easily crossed, and it deals with not only the line between countries, but the metaphorical lines between people and ways of being. Here's a taste from the story Chasing the Dragon.
Those few seconds when you had the taste of the apocalypse in the touch of another man or another woman, you want to do it again and again, and the dragon reappears, and after a while he disappears, and you go looking for him again, and you find another body, and you find him again, the dragon, and you want to live with him forever, but you can't.
We'll hear more from the story as Benjamin O'Leary Sines reads from his collection, Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club, which also won the 2013 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. And he shares some poetry at this public reading at the Writer's Place, recorded in September 2013 for New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and here to introduce Sines is former UMKC English professor for the Latino Studies Program, Dr. Norma Cantu.
Benjamin O'Leary Sines was born in Picacho, New Mexico, and raised near Mesilla. He entered St. Thomas Seminary in Colorado after graduating from Las Cruces High School. He received his BA and also studied in Belgium when he was at the seminary. After leaving the priesthood, however, he returned to school and received his MA from UTEP, the University of Texas and El Paso. From UTEP, he went on to Iowa as a doctoral student. He received the first of many awards, the Wallace E. Stegner Fellowship, and so then he went to Stanford. There, under the tutelage of Denise Levertov, he finished Calendar of Dust, his first collection of poems. As a doctoral student at Stanford, he began writing fiction also. And so his first novel, Carry Me Like Water, was published. He has published over 20 books of both poetry, children's literature, young adult literature, and of course, his fiction. He is a lover of words and of the savage beauty that is the border. When he received the Penn Faulkner Award for his most recent collection of fiction, Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club, I rejoiced. He had received many awards before that, but of course the Penn Faulkner is one of the biggies. The other thing I want to tell you about Ben is that his gentle soul, his spirit that imbues every single one of his works, the novels, the short stories, the poems, I think is what makes us all human, and that is the poetic sensitivity of being a human being, of surviving all of the angst that we go through of living, especially as writers, and especially in a land like the border, with all its violence and all its beauty, and to be able to write about it and passionately convey those feelings to others, I think is such a wonderful gift. Without any further ado, I introduce to you Benjamin O'Leary Sines.
I'm going to read some poems, and I'm going to read a section of a story from Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club. My stories are much too long to read. I don't really write short stories. I write stories that want to grow up to be novels. I'm working on a new collection of poetry entitled He, You, I. They're all about me, really, but from different perspectives. When you write about yourself as a he, then you write differently about yourself. And then when you use the second person you, it's different too. And then I, it's like becoming integrated. So this poem is entitled Roads. 1. Reading Robert Frost ruined roads for him. Those two roads converging scared and screwed him up. It was as if he was being forced to make a decision about his life before he had a life. He'd think and think about roads. One day, he decided to decide. He bought a pack of cigarettes and fell in love with smoking. That was the road he took. Not a good decision, but smoking gave him a life. And that has made all the difference. 2. He is always photographing roads. He's never happy with the outcome. Happiness isn't everything. Not that he'd know. He keeps thinking he'll take a perfect picture someday of a road, lonely and beautiful. He loves only lonely roads. He has no patience with traffic and crowded freeways. Being a lover of roads has never made him a good driver. He never knows where he's going. Give him a camera and an empty road that disappears into the horizon as if it were a part of nature. The open road is larger and more generous than anything Jack Kerouac ever imagined. Kerouac never knew where he was going either. 3. He can't bear Kerouac. He suspects Kerouac was in love with all the tricks his penis could do. That's why he always had to hit the road. He always got himself into penis trouble. He was a pre-feminist, unreconstructed man's man. That doesn't mean he wasn't beautiful. If he had met Kerouac, he probably would have fallen in love with him. And then there's the thing with hands he has, the way they move and betray all the secrets he keeps. Hands don't have it in them to lie. 4. He wonders if anyone has taken a really close look at the hands on the figures of a Velázquez painting. Those hands are forever longing, forever reaching, forever hungry. They belong to the hands of saints. They look like the hands of Jews in a concentration camp, fleshless and pale. He wishes those hands could touch him. They would be like a road. They would take him to a place he's never seen, to a place where the darkness meets the light.
Benjamin O'Leary Sines, reading his poem Roads at the Writer's Place in Kansas City. This is New Letters on the Air.
I'm going to read just a couple more poems, then I'm going to read a section of Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club. And by the way, thank you all for coming. You're a lovely audience. It's such a pleasure to be here. This poem is called Translating Heidegger. I used to study philosophy. I never did get Heidegger. Translating Heidegger. The sudden urge to understand a difficult passage from Heidegger. The urge becomes an obsession. And he wakes whispering, Dasein. He thinks of Tom, his easy laugh, his deep and generous voice. He envied all Tom's understanding. At 20, Tom is perfect, his dark Italian eyes exploding with the secrets of German philosophy. He pictures himself taking notes as Tom explains, interprets, 4 or 5 of them gathered in his room, idiot students with so little hunger for knowledge. He is smoking a cigarette as he listens to Tom's voice, and he is thinking of incense. Tom was a good priest. He explained Descartes to anyone around him who would listen. But one day, Tom hungered for another kind of knowledge. He looked up from the pages of a book and saw a woman. All the angels fell away. Amo ergo sum. And him, he could never be like Tom. He never gave a damn about Descartes, never gave a damn about Heidegger, though he liked pronouncing his name. He's sorry for all his shallowness, for other things too. He knew he could never be too sorry. He was Catholic after all. No, he could never be sorry enough. Now, in his dreams, there are birds falling from the sky. He has started to paint all the birds. A friend keeps asking him what they mean, the birds in the paintings. They can't fly, they're just falling. He can't explain. He's not Carl Jung. He's not even an art critic. Maybe not even a good painter. Maybe he's just internalized an old Hitchcock movie that was more or less about desire and sexual repression. Another phrase slaps into his brain. Yaram des Sein. He waits for the translation, but it does not arrive. He sees the words written on the gates of a camp. His abilities as a translator are not improving. There are many arts he will never master. Beethoven was deaf. Goya too. There were monsters in their heads that drove them mad. All the dazzling darkness of the death. But him? His hearing is fine. What good is that? His life has become a series of bad translations. This means that, and that means this. This and that have nothing to do with art. Goya, Beethoven, Heidegger, all the great translators are themselves untranslatable. He's thinking of his former lives. He is rummaging through boxes, tossing out photographs and fragments of his past. Why did he say this, and this, and this? He finds a box of bullets. When his father was sick, he bought a gun. His father wanted to kill Parkinson's, doctors, himself. One day, his father woke shouting and shouting at his mother, "¿Dónde está la pistola?" His brother got rid of the gun. And him? He wound up with the bullets. What will he do with them? Him, who owns no gun. Goya would have known what to do with the bullets. Beethoven, too. He picked onions as a boy. The stench of rotting onions assaults him in unexpected moments. Even now, after so many years, that stench comes back to him. He turns, almost expecting to see himself at 13, bending to clip the roots of an onion with steel scissors that leave his hands calloused and angry at the earth. Reuben eats onions like apples. He has discovered the sweetness of onions. He envies his friend. His grandmother had a peach tree. She spent summers chasing away the birds, an art she never mastered. Here they are again, the birds. He remembers thinking that his grandmother would have done anything to protect her peaches. Yes, she would have shot every last bird that invaded her tree, except she hated guns. Once she stared down a cop who kept his gun in his holster during Mass. Jesus did die for that. Not for that. Sometimes he's sorry he didn't become a farmer. He would have grown acres of organic tomatoes. He would have paid poor city boys 5 cents for every worm they picked off the plants. Boys should know about worms and tomatoes, how they grow, the dangers they faced, what it cost them to survive as they ripened into the color of his blood. He got lost on the first day of school. He spent years looking for himself. He thinks he's finally found at least a piece of himself that he can trust. He doesn't dream the devil anymore. When he was 5, the devil was always chasing him. Maybe it was only Descartes' evil genius. It's true. When he was a boy, the devil wanted him, his mind, his body, his heart. Perhaps the devil managed to steal a piece of his heart and has kept it ever since. Descartes, the devil, and now there are birds. He doesn't know what all these flecks and fragments are trying to tell him. Maybe he deserves all the things that wander in and out of his dreams. Who is to say what we all deserve? The Nazis knew. Dick Cheney, he knew. Dasein, ¿dónde está la pistola? The river is poor and dirty, but water is water. Born in the desert, he came into this world a thirsty man. He will always love the river. He could write that in any language the world has ever known. Tom explaining Dasein, Reuben eating an onion. his grandmother holding a perfect peach, birds falling from the sky. This is what life is, an endless stream of memories. When he wakes from his dreams, he will step into the waters.
You're listening to Benjamin O'Leary Signs here on New Letters on the Air, reading from his forthcoming book, He, You, I.
I write a lot about Juarez in this new book. I have a lot of odes to Juarez. And a friend of mine whose name is Dudley Althouse works for the Houston Chronicle. And he used to cover Mexico City until the Houston Chronicle decided very recently that Mexico City isn't worth covering, so they don't cover Mexico anymore, which is very sad. But he wrote an article about some of the murders. They form a part of the poem, and they're in italics in the poem. God send an angel. Bodies get dumped in empty lots and roadsides, heaped together in cases of massacre, or laid out alone if that's how the victim died. Police recover corpses stuffed in cars, tumbled into clandestine tombs, laid out like Scrabble pieces to form letters. He, the man, is reading the newspaper on the internet. A photographer is taking black ink and writing, boycott hate, on people's arms. The photographer dresses his subjects in white. He is creating an army of tattooed angels. Today, four journalists were kidnapped in Durango. This will be the man's morning prayer, their names on his lips. Jaime, Héctor, Oscar, Alejandro. The man stares into the sweet face of the photographer who, like his subjects, dresses himself in white. He too looks like an angel. The man is reading what the photographer has to say about his work. The artist is articulate. He is intelligent. He is handsome. He is an innocent. He has not spent much time hiking the bloody and unforgiving terrain of the Americas. The artist believes the world can be touched by a dream, by a photograph. In Juarez, two headless bodies lie bleeding on the street. They have been posed there by performance artists. The bystanders pick up the notes pinned to their bodies. They stand on the sidewalk and read the lines with terror. They all have their assigned roles. There is a part for everyone to play. This is the new democracy. This is the only theater we have left. This is what the man is thinking. To spend your days looking at the faces of young men who don't yet wear the cruelty of the world on their scarless skins. To spend your days like that. Journalists find their bodies on the streets of Juarez or Baghdad or Kandahar. This is how the nations train them to be men. With decapitations becoming almost cliche, now arms and legs get severed too. One victim in Ciudad Juarez was found crucified on a chain-link fence with a pig's head attached to his torso. Another reportedly had his face stitched to a soccer ball. God, send an angel over the waters of chaos and make it new again. A prayer the man once uttered in a moment of belief. Jaime, Héctor, Oscar, Alejandro. A day after, soldiers and investigators uncovered the graves. The yard stood abandoned. Attention turned to the bodies of four young men dumped last week in a busy intersection in Monterrey and gun battles in Nuevo Laredo. A student writes to him and asks, "You know about anger. You conjure that so well. Is there any happiness or joy?" How can he find his innocence again? How can he conjure joy in such a world as this.
That's the poem God Send an Angel by Benjamin O'Leary Sines. Listen for his fiction just ahead on New Letters on the Air.
I'm sorry, but my poetry isn't for the faint of heart. So I'm going to end this reading with a little section from Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club. The Kentucky Club is a bar in Juarez that was opened up in 1920. And it was a big part of the scene during Prohibition in El Paso and Juarez, because El Paso ones didn't care about Prohibition. We just walked over to Juarez and drank. Well, I wasn't alive then, but I would have. So the Kentucky Club is really one of those famous bars that's still in business. A lot of them have gone out of business. So this is called Chasing the Dragon, and it is really about a brother and a sister who live very tragic lives. Chasing the Dragon. I have a black and white photograph of my mother and father sitting in a Juarez bar. My father looks like he's drunk, his white shirt wrinkled, his striped tie loosened, his black hair tousled. It amazes me that even in a drunken state, my father retains a charm that could be captured by a camera. My mother, an ethereal beauty with piercing green eyes, is looking away, staring off into the distance. Neither of them appears to be happy. My parents, in and out of photographs, were an arresting couple. People envied them. They walked into rooms and turned heads. I suspect they enjoyed their public performances. The minute they stepped out into the public eye, they were celebrities, the center of the spinning world. Their physical beauty aside, they lived tortured, miserable lives. With an authority that only her voice could convey, my Aunt Lucille once told me that the picture was taken at the Hawaiian. Your mother loved that place. She loved the decor, the Mai Tais, and the bartender. Your father hated that hellhole. He thought it was cheap and charmless. Then she reluctantly handed me back the photograph. Conrad, I don't know what possesses you to keep that picture. My Uncle Louis, whose only regret in life was that he would never have the courage to divorce Lucille, the woman he married, pulled me aside and said, Conrad, that picture was taken at the Kentucky Club. The Hawaiian closed years before that picture was taken. My Uncle Louis was addicted to pulling me aside and whispering his versions of family history into my ears. It was his way of making me his co-conspirator, not that I ever trusted or believed him. My other uncle, Hector, who was as unreliable as all the rest of the adults in my family, informed me that the picture was taken after my mother caught my father with another woman. After that, she refused to let him step foot into the Kentucky Club. Why? I asked. It was his favorite bar. Oh, I said. I think it's safe to say that everyone in my family was more interested in punitive measures than in forgiveness. She had an affair of her own, you know. Was he at least a nice man? Conrad, I'm not saying this to be cruel, but your mother didn't know any nice men. So they never forgave each other? My uncle Hector scratched his head and smiled. Let's just say that in this family, forgiveness has a statute of limitations. That made me laugh. How long is the statute? Uncle Hector gave me a look. He had a sense of irony, but he had no sense of humor. If you're not on your knees within the week, it's over. Then why isn't anybody in this family divorced? I don't have an answer for that, he said. I think my Uncle Hector did have an answer for that. He just wasn't going to tell me. My own theory was that everybody in our family had the same phobia. They were all afraid of being happy. Uncle Hector gently took the picture from my hand and stared at it. It was taken in 1980, exactly 1 year and 12 days after your sister had been born. And it was taken at Martino's. I should know. I joined them for dinner that night. Your father was drunk, as you can see, he said as he pointed at the image of my mother. Melissa was as untouchable and inscrutable as ever. She was always somewhere else, as if she was above being in the same room with anyone who resembled a human being. Just because she looked like an angel didn't mean she was one. My uncle was a disappointed writer who read books that, quote, didn't deserve to be published. He also had a penchant for dictionaries. It was a habit I picked up from him. He used to sit me on his lap when I was a boy and we would look up words. And he liked using all those words he looked up, words like inscrutable. Not that his description of my mother was inaccurate. She was the most inscrutable woman who ever lived. She was a mystery no one ever solved. She admitted it herself. When I was 8, I was caught in the middle of an argument between her and my father. My father raged at her. Who in the f*** are you, Melissa? Just who the f*** are you? My mother casually lit a cigarette and calmly whispered, I am unknowable. She spoke the words slowly and with certainty. She blew out the smoke from her cigarette and added, I thought that was why you married me, Octavio. And anyway, you don't like knowing women. You just like owning them. My parents were theater. My sister Carmen and I were the audience. Even the photograph of the two of them that I'm addicted to studying seems like a still from a movie. My Aunt Susan, who loved a man once but never married, said the photograph was taken at the Copacabana. Love that place. It opened up in 1979, she said. Your parents went there a lot. Yes, she said. It was definitely taken at the Copa, 1981. I remember the dress. My Aunt Susan remembered dresses better than she remembered faces. I didn't believe any of them. My uncles and aunts were the kind of people who like to conceal more than they like to reveal. I even took the photograph with me to Juarez one night and decided to venture into all the places that were still there. That was 1999. I was 17 and the violence hadn't erupted yet and people still trafficked back and forth to have a drink and eat dinner. By 1999, the Hawaiian was long gone. I went to the Copa, studied the place, and decided that the picture had definitely not been taken there. I went to the Florida, a place that hadn't been mentioned, but it definitely wasn't where the photograph had been taken. I had a drink at the Kentucky Club and thought it was a possibility. I met my sister Carmen for dinner at Martino's that night, and it was then that I decided that Martino's was the place. Definitely Martino's. You're probably right, Carmen said. I hate that picture. Why? Look at them. They're miserable. Yes, I said. But they're beautiful, too.
That's from the story Chasing the Dragon in Benjamin O'Leary Sine's book, Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club, winner of both the Penn Faulkner and the Lambda Literary Awards in 2013, the year he was recorded at the Writer's Place in Kansas City. Due out in 2017 is a follow-up to his prize-winning young adult novel, Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, and a new poetry collection. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City. For more, visit our website, newletters.org. Today's show was produced with Stephanie Hughes, Ross Steinmetz, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.